welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that my overarching focus is dynamic interrelatedness, hence the name All Together Now. That is, I'm interested in both the many, many recent discoveries that physical reality, including humans, is far, far more interrelated than even we holistic thinkers had realized 10 years ago. And also, I'm interested in the many, many ways in which this growing realization of dynamic interrelatedness is changing, that is, correcting, the ways we think, the ways our institutions think about issues, and the way we do things. So regular listeners also know that since mid-August, I've headed into my electoral campaign mode, and I've invited guests to come on All Together Now who are politically engaged, but in ways that build on the emergent awareness of interrelatedness. So we've heard thus far from George Lakoff, Joanna Macy, Terry Tempest Williams, Sandra Steingraber, and we're going to keep it up till Election Day with the guests in the coming weeks, who include Marianne Williamson. She's got a great event coming up right after the election for women who might consider running for office. Check out the website sistergiant.org, sistergiant.org. After her, Gus Speth, author of America the Possible, then Nina Simons, co-director of Bioneers, and Sarah Van Gelder, editor of Yes Magazine. But great as those folks are, I need a break from politics today, and maybe you do too. This doesn't mean we'll flake out and fail to do our patriotic duty in the electoral process. And this year, when so many voters are going to be blocked from voting on November 6th, it's extremely important that we all try to help young voters or otherwise unregistered citizens get registered to vote for the first time before your state's deadline. And that's coming up in a couple of weeks. Check with your state government's website for their cutoff date. But for this hour, let's just step away from all that and take a deep breath. Now, what I'm going to do on this program is bring you up to date, back, returning to the overarching subject of All Together Now, bring you up to date with some of the very recent, that is, within the past year, discoveries that have been made about the dynamic interrelatedness of reality. And as always, they're very surprising because they go against the grain of the modern way that we were schooled, that trained us to see the world in a certain way, a mechanistic way in which everything is a discrete entity and they're essentially separative, whether or not these discrete entities happen to be clustered or in relationship with other separative entities doesn't really matter much to the way they function or even are structured. Well, that's wrong. It's a projection. So let me first set the context here. I'll tell you how I became interested in this large subject. I started wondering about why the last time there was a huge shift in thinking onto the mechanistic model of reality, which was in the 18th century after the Scientific Revolution, and the 16th and 17th century had established a mechanistic worldview based on their observations that the world is really a machine. It operates on machine-like principles. And so then in the 18th century, all our institutions were remodeled to match that latest finding from science. So everything went onto the machine model, including even garden design in France. It's very geometric and machine-like. And certainly the modern medical field evolved to be in sync with the mechanistic projection that the body is essentially a biomachine. So within about 100 years, that is the 18th century, what was called the new mechanical philosophy flowed into the general culture and, as I say, changed all the institutions. So what I started wondering about was why, now that we seem to be making a big corrective turn off the mechanistic model onto the realization that reality is dynamically interrelated, which isn't really new. All the indigenous cultures of the world saw reality that way through their perceptions. But it is a huge shift, and yet why is it taking way more than 100 years this time? You'd think with all our modern communications, high-speed communications, that kind of a change would move faster instead of more slowly. But Einstein's first paper in 1905, first two papers, indicating that indeed reality was dynamically interrelated, is now, we are now past the 100-year mark on that. And look around. Do you see all the institutions redesigned? I mean, even after all the discoveries in quantum physics that came out in the ensuing decades, and then in the 1980s, 1990s, lots of exciting discoveries coming out of complexity studies and science, especially the biological sciences. You know, they suddenly determined, oh, gee, it's not like a machine, and you can't even predict, which is what the whole mechanistic scientific worldview is about, predicting what's going to happen, laws and predicting and control. You can't predict what's going to happen within a living system because its component parts are merely what then is in play, and it's interrelating to its environment, to all the parts, and new realities are coming into being all the time in a dynamic manner. So, you know, this was exciting, but again, I'm looking around, oh, I don't know, 10 years ago and saying, oh, what is the block? Why is this taking so long? And I'm really not sure, except I think maybe the discoveries coming into the general culture announced by physics and complexity studies were too abstract maybe to make much of a difference in most people's lives. And so I just figured around then, well, it's not going to happen in my lifetime. This grand correction off the mechanistic way of seeing reality onto the organic, dynamically interrelated way, it's got to happen eventually because that's the way reality works, but I'm just not going to be seeing it in my lifetime. So, okay. And then, to my surprise, I started noticing in the newspaper small articles buried back away from the front page, and they were often in the weekly health section, New York Times, LA Times, and these were discoveries of what I've come to call relational physiology, that the human body-mind is continually in dynamic relationship with the environment around it, with other people, with organs inside of it, and it doesn't work at all like a separative biomachine. So this has been known in incremental amounts over recent years, but there's been a huge leap in the amount of information coming out of studies, these findings that have supported a relational understanding of physiology. And it's moving through all the other fields as well. It's not just physiology, health and healing. It's all the fields. So once I started accumulating a lot of this clippings and tracking down the full studies online, I thought, well, really, this should be brought together. So that's what I did with the book last year, Relational Reality, New Discoveries of Interrelatedness That Are Transforming the Modern World. And then when the book went to press last spring, I mean, spring of 2011, I thought, well, at least I can stop clipping all those articles out of the paper now and printing out everything online. But I kept seeing announcements of discoveries And of course, I found them so fascinating that I just kept clipping them and stuffing them into a file. So then last winter, I got the invitation from Progressive Radio Network to host a weekly program, and I knew instantly what I would want to do it on, which is this big shift, the relational shift that's going on in so many fields now because of these recent, concrete, accessible discoveries, most of them since the year 2000, about the dynamic, interrelated nature of humans and all reality. So I consider, and I've kept, by the way, clipping things that I don't even have time to get onto the show. So there are really, in my mind, three repositories if you're interested in seeing all these discoveries. One, as I say, is the book Relational Reality that I wrote in 2011. Two are the archival tapings of this program, which Progressive Radio Network kindly keeps in very good shape, accessible to all of you for free at any hour of the day. And that covers a lot of areas where this relational shift is happening. Since I started the program in April, we've heard from people in the front lines or whatever of areas like the relational cultural model of the self, which is now very big in the field of psychology, wellness coaches, that's a function of this growing realization of how interrelated our health is, and eco-literacy, what's happening in the schools to try to teach this reality, and what's new in criminal justice, well, it's the restorative justice movement, which is entirely relational. Some of the big news in education, teaching resiliency, turns out that's based on teaching them how to cultivate supportive relationships. So in lots of different fields, you can look in the archives of Altogether Now on PRN and hear from people who are really making it happen how this big shift is changing all the fields and all the institutions. And then there is, as I say, a third place where I'm keeping these, and it's this bulging file I've got. I'll give you a few examples today. But also I've made a page on Facebook. So if you go into Facebook and type Relational Reality, I've posted 10 examples from the book of these new discoveries. And if you come across in your internet browsing or if you see it in your own local paper, an article about one of these new studies, it'll usually refer you, even if it's just a small newspaper article, it mentions the name of the journal that the study's in. You can take a look. If you go to that website, it'll have a one-paragraph summary. Anyway, if you come across any discovery of interrelatedness in any field, and would like to add it to this growing collection, you're very welcome to post it there on the Facebook page for Relational Reality. Okay, let's take a look at a few examples. Again, to orient people, if they're new to the program, I'll just mention some of the ones, just about three or so, that are in the book before I go into these more recent ones. There was a very interesting series of four studies that was done in 2009 that showed people who were shown slides of entirely human-made environments were given a survey afterwards, and they ranked money, fame, and or power as the highest values in human life. But people who were shown slides of nature photography and afterwards given the survey ranked caring, generosity, and personal relationships and community as their prime values. So, I mean, one could conclude that nature enables us to be our true caring, generous, and expansive selves. It seems to free us of self-absorption, disengagement, and diminished empathy. And that's a big problem because I also mentioned elsewhere in the book those studies that measure empathy in young adults. And one study that was done at the University of Michigan, actually it was a meta study looking at many, many studies over 30, 40 years, said empathy among young people just fell off a cliff around the year 2000, and it's much lower than it was 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. So that means they hear friends and colleagues talking about bad things that have happened to me, and they don't have much of a sympathetic response. It's very interesting, and I'm not sure why, but of course you can make lots of guesses having to do with maybe the way the electronic immersion shapes the childhood now in more interning ways than used to be the case. Anyway, going back to these studies I just mentioned, I want to tell you a few quotes here that are not in the book. So the researchers concluded that nature and immersion had a remarkable interacting effect, predicting decision-making and a higher valuing of what they called intrinsic values and a lower value of what they called extrinsic values, like money, fame, image, and public image. And they also suggested that from their findings, research brings individuals closer to others, whereas human-made environments orient goals more towards selfish or self-interested ends. So the way one of them expressed it, immersion in non-nature settings thwarts natural experiences of relatedness and autonomy. Mm-hmm. And this is, as they said, quote, consistent with speculations that living in modern non-nature environments may have a powerful isolating and or self-alienating effect on people. Wow, I'm taken back to William Morris's dream in the 1880s that when we come into cities from the countryside, it wouldn't be that much of a radical break. The trees would just continue. The native plants would just continue into the city. And there are cities who are making a big effort to green themselves now, which has a lot of effects on health and air quality. Anyway, that's what those studies found. Here's another one I think is interesting. I guess the word's gotten around that you know, relationships among the elderly is a very good way to ward off dementia. It'll reduce the extent to which you're in the risk category. But a study in 2009 found that they looked at 906 elderly adults and found that those with fewer friendships and other social interactions experienced a more rapid decline in motor function, such as walking, gripping, and balancing. So truly, we are relational beings. It's just not understood the inherent nature to which we are so relational. And in a way, there's a pathos involved because here it is, 2012, and they're just making these really elementary discoveries about the nature of the human. Anyway, they're being made, and that's a good thing. Oh, I thought this was interesting, too, a last one from the book. Researchers ascertained in 2007 that for people of all ages, 10 minutes of talking with someone, either in person or even by phone, boosts mental performance and memory as much as doing crossword puzzles for the same amount of time. And it was found that the more social contact people have, the higher their level of mental functioning. Okay, let's take a look at some of these new things here. One of them was about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of talk about supplements now, and there are a lot of studies say, oh, it's all baloney, don't take that junk, it'll even hurt you. And then there's other work done by Gary Null and others showing supplements are so powerful that Big Pharma is on the way to getting their clutches around them, so you won't be able to buy them in natural food stores anymore. You'd have to be paying for prescriptions. Mm-hmm. Anyway, This is a study about fertility, and it found men, it was about men who take antioxidants, and it found that the wives of men who take antioxidants are more likely to get pregnant. And they studied 1,178 couples. This study was published by the Cochrane Library, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E, Cochrane, looks like, R-A-N-E, Library. Unfortunately, I cut this out of the paper and forgot to put the date on it, but you can find it online with that information, I think. It's antioxidants and male fertility. Effective supplements included vitamin E, L-carnitine, zinc, and magnesium. And then there was one just a couple of months ago. You may have seen this in your local news source. This study that found out that babies benefit by having a pet in the house. Infants in houses with pets get sick less frequently than other children. And this is the clipping I have. It was in the Los Angeles Times, July 9th. The title is Dirty Dog, Happy Baby. The journalist is Amina Khan. You can find it that way, K-H-A-N. It says a new study finds that children who lived with dogs or cats during their first year of life got sick less frequently than kids from pet-free zones. And this is published that week, July 9th, 2012, in the journal called Pediatrics. and it said previous research had shown that owning a cat or dog was associated with less risk of gastroenteritis in young children. But this is much broader. Other studies had shown that pets bring in helpful bacteria. For instance, a paper presented just the month before this, it says, found that mice that were fed dust from homes with dogs were less likely than other mice to contract respiratory syncytial virus, which is thought to play a main role in the development of childhood asthma. So this study was done of 397 Finnish children born between September 2002 and May 2005. And they found that the effect was much stronger in homes that had dogs instead of cats. Babies who lived with dogs were 31% more likely to be in good health than their counterparts who didn't. Babies who lived with cats had a 6% advantage over babies who didn't have a cat or dog. And it said about particular infections, children with dogs were 44% less likely to develop ear infections and 29% less likely to have to use antibiotics in their first year. You want to keep them off those. So the researchers made some guesses as to why this could be. They say, well, pets that spend more time outdoors probably bring in dirt to the homes, and those give babies more opportunities to encounter this exposure of different kinds of bacteria. And that exposure could have caused their immune systems to mature faster than they otherwise would have. So, and then there was this article here in February, and this is pros and cons of having infants sleep in the baby in the bed with the parents. This is in the LA Times, February 20th, 2012. In bed with baby on board. It's the name of the article, journalist Jessica Pauline Ogilvy. So it's citing studies here. Dr. William Sears, who's arguing in favor of it, he wrote the baby sleep book. And he says that when babies and moms are close together, babies' stress hormones have been shown to go down, and its oxygen intake is more stable. When a baby is unattended to at night or sleeps apart from its mother, its stress hormones may become higher. When the baby has high stress hormones, it depletes the immune system, raises the heart rate, and can even damage the brain. So he's citing research that's shown it's best for babies to stay within sensory distance from the mother. Sensory distance is the distance in which sensory perception can be made, sight or hearing or touch. So, again, this is our culture. Immediately separating the babies, first in the nursery, if the hospital doesn't have a rooming in system. I mean, you know, it's much smarter if they have the crib next to the mother's bed. And then when you get home, you know, you're told to put the baby in a separate room in a nursery. But both of these doctors, arguing pro and con, say it's best to have the baby sleeping at least in a crib right near the bed, so they can sense that the mother's body-mind is nearby. That's their anchor. That's their touchstone for relational rightness. And it also makes the point that since many mothers work outside the home during the day, when they share a bed at night, it gives them the closeness and touch that they miss during the day. And this that has been found to be beneficial to the baby's development. Yes, touch, eye-to-eye contact cannot be replaced. So, and then there was, oh dear, I need to pause here for the break. We'll be right back with some more, but this is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now. Now that we know it, let's really show it, darling. Let's give them something to talk about, something to talk about. Let a mystery to figure out, something to talk about. Let's give them something to talk about. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. So I'm talking today about recent discoveries about the interrelated nature of reality that have escaped the way our mechanistic worldview has set up our institutions. But things are getting better. This is a big corrective shift going on. One of these areas is the really interesting work that's been done in recent years in what's informally called the baby labs. There's one at Yale University and about three or four other universities thus far, where they're studying the reasoning of infants, the thought processes they can observe. And there was this one study done at Yale of the moral reasoning of infants. This was not within the past year. It was a year or two before that. But there was a big article in the New York Times. It would be easy to find online references to their work. And one of the things they did was they had babies, I think they were between, was it 9 and 12 months? Anyway, they were sort of toward the end of their first year. They could sit up and they liked to look at something that engaged their attention. So they would provide a little puppet show, and then they would watch the baby's reactions. So when the characters in the puppet show were climbing up a steep mountainside, and one of the characters was having trouble making the climb, and another character reached behind and helped the character up the mountain, they like that. The babies are smiling. Oh, yes, they like that. And then in the version of the play where the characters are going up the steep mountainside, one of them's having trouble, and the other one turns around and pushes him off the mountainside. They did not like that. Those little infants had a very negative reaction to that aggression. And so the researchers concluded, you know, that they have a sense of right and wrong that's there, if not innately, awfully early. And one of the researchers made this statement, the morality of contemporary humans really does outstrip what evolution could possibly have endowed us with. Moral actions are often of a sort that have no plausible relation to our reproductive success and do not appear to be accidental byproducts of evolved adaptations. So I just want to say that I think his puzzlement, where could this come from? Where could this relational kind of thinking come from in such practically newborn humans? All right, infants. He says, I don't think it came from the pressures of natural selection that, you know, work toward favoring what will get your genes into the next generation. Well, I think that puzzlement only occurs if you stay in the mechanistic worldview that we're all born as these discrete, separative little entities, and why would we care about this other little lump next to us? But if you have an understanding of the interrelated nature of reality, all of physical reality, including humans, then you can see we come out of dynamic relatedness. We come out of the processes of the planet. We come out of the birth of the universe. We're just inherently, dynamically interrelated. Interrelationships are us. That's what they might be thinking about with these babies instead of, gee, where would this come from? So this is an example of why we're definitely still in a moment that's transitional. I'm not saying we're there yet at all, but there are a lot of good developments. One of them was this report that was released last March by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And this was on America's women veterans, military service history, and VA benefit utilization statistics. It's looking at the different therapeutic responses that are available. And about one-third of women veterans in this country use the VA system, it said. The top, in terms of numbers, and most serious disabling condition among female veterans is post-traumatic stress disorder. And according to the Department of Veterans Affairs National Center for PTSD, women are more likely than men to develop PTSD from traumatic experiences, such as sexual assault during their time in service. And this now has a name, military sexual trauma. Well, why would that be? You know, there have been many perceptual experiments done in psychology since 1953, the famous one that determined when it comes to perception that men tend to see the foreground figures in a scene or a design, and women tend to see the gestalt. They see the total. The researchers then put a patriarchal spin on that and said, oh, let's give them these labels. Let's see. The men will be called field independent, and we'll call the women field dependent because, you know, they're sort of influenced by what's around them and they're not good, strong thinkers. But now that we see that reality is actually dynamically interrelated, the people who can see this, who tend to see the relational gestalt, have a talent that society really needs. Anyway, I would guess that the reason women are more susceptible to developing PTSD is because we're extremely relational, and that's for evolutionary reasons, of course, but it sure comes in handy now in the relational shift. Anyway, the point of this study was, against what you might expect if you had a biomechanical model of the body, they found that a study in which 20 sexually abused veterans, women who received twice a week Swedish massage sessions for 1 month, showed significant improvements psychologically related to depression, anxiety, and life event stress. And again, with the mechanistic model, they've got a problem in their head. Are you kidding? What you're saying you're going to touch them and it's going to make their head think better? What are you talking about? But in fact, that's exactly what happens. So many participants, the study says, felt empowered, present, and soothed following the massage treatments. Participants' psychotherapists suggested speedy breakthroughs where progress was not present prior to the body work therapy. One of the most important points to note here is the fact that body-mind therapy stimulated the motivation to heal, which is normally not present due to specific vulnerability of this population, manifested in depression, lack of self-worth, and emotional volatility following the rape. So, again, that's just another incidence of we have to shift the whole medical profession onto the understanding of relational physiology if they really want to have better results from treating actual humans. Now, there are a few negative findings, too, I want to get into just so we know. This is extremely interesting. Here's an article that came out April 25th, 2012, in the LA Times. Violence erodes DNA of children, study says. Children who are exposed to violence experience wear and tear to their DNA similar to that seen in aging, according to a new study that may help explain why they face a heightened risk of mental and physical disorders as adults. In a long-term study of 118 pairs of identical twins, researchers at Duke University found that boys and girls who had experienced violence had shorter genetic structures called telomeres than youngsters who had more peaceful upbringings. The children in the former group had been physically abused by an adult or bullied frequently or had witnessed, get this, witnessing violence changed their DNA structure. Or had witnessed domestic violence between the ages of 5 and 10, and the more types of violence a child had experienced, the faster his or her telomeres eroded. So these findings were published, it says Tuesday, that's sometime around April 25th, 2012, in the journal called Molecular Psychiatry. Over life, these telomeres get shorter and shorter every time a cell divides. After about 50 or 60 cell divisions, the telomeres become so small that the cell begins to shut itself down. So you can see what that means if they've already started shortening in childhood. It says later in the study, this takes about 10 years off their adult life. Again, I think one of the most interesting findings here is how relational we are. A child need only witness violence repeatedly between ages 5 and 10 to have a physiological response that over time is affecting how long they live. Okay, there's a whole bunch more that completely go against our expectations. I think they're fascinating, and I'll continue sometime, but that's all the time we have for the updates today. So let's move over to the Arts Corner. And actually, turns out, I didn't think of this, but it is a little related to the last study. The poem for today is one I saw in The New Yorker and found so striking that I cut it out. Unfortunately, I did forget to write the date on it, but this poem is justifiably enraged about violations of girls, yet it maintains the artfulness of the poem throughout. I didn't know anything about the poet, whose name is Jennifer Michael Hecht. That's spelled H-E-C-H-T. But I have since found out that she's the author of three books exploring historical aspects of philosophical subjects and two volumes of poetry. Her bestseller, Doubt, A History, demonstrates what she calls a long, strong history of religious doubt. Her books of poetry are The Next Ancient World, which won three National Poetry Awards, and Funny. This poem is surely not in her collection entitled Funny. Maybe it's in the earlier book. Anyway, here is the poem by Jennifer Michael Hecht entitled Gender Bender. evolution settles for a while on various stable balances. One is that some of the girls like cute boys, and some like ugly older men, and sometimes women. The difference between them is the ones who like older men were felt up by their fathers or uncles or older brothers, or, if he didn't touch you, still lived in his cauldron of curses and urges, which could be just as worse. They grow already old, angry, and wise. They get rich, get mean, get theirs. The untouched, uncursed others are happy, never needing to do much, and never do much more than good. They envy their mean, rich, talented, drunk sisters. Good girls drink milk and make milk and know they've missed out and know they're better off. They might dance and design, but won't rip out lungs for a flag. Bad ones write books and slash red paint on canvas. They've rage to vent. They've fault lines and will rip a toga off a Caesar and stab a goat for ether. It's as simple as that. Either deep in the dark of your history, someone showed you that you could be used as a cash machine, as a popcorn popper, as a rocket launch, as a coin slot jackpot spunker, or he didn't, and you grew up unused and clueless. Either you got a clue and spiked lunch, or you got zilch but no punch, and you never knew. It's exactly not anyone's fault. If it happened and you don't like older men, that's just because you like them so much you won't let yourself have one. If you did, people would see. Then they would know what happened a long time ago with you and that original him, whose eyes you've been avoiding for decades, gone, forgotten. That's why you date men smaller than you, or not at all, or maybe you've turned into a man. It isn't anyone's fault. It's just human, and it's just what happens or doesn't happen. That's that. Any questions? If you see a girl dressed to say, "No one tells me what to do," you know someone once told her what to do. Whew. Well, our song for today is lighter than that, but it's still kind of in the general universe of male-female relationships of a problematic nature. It's performed by Kate and Anna McGarrigle, and it's Dancer with Bruised Knees from their album of the same name in 1977. When their first album, which was entitled simply Kate and Anna McGarrigle, came out the year before, it made a considerable splash, as did this one. The critic John Rockwell wrote in the New York Times, quote, "Their voices have a plaintive allure full of light bravado and husky emotionalism, and they blend together exquisitely in harmonies," unquote. So true. Or at least it was until Kate McGarrigle died of cancer about 2.5 years ago at age 62. And, by the way, her funeral was televised in Canada. They were national figures. Their sound was so fresh and idiosyncratic in the 1970s that it seemed, at least to me, to be a great fit with the feeling of new possibilities and creativity that were in the air then. I want to tell you a little bit about their formative years because it's so very different from the way most children are coming of age today, glued to electronic devices. Kate and Anna McGarrigle and their older sister Jane, who is a composer today in Canada. They were born in Montreal and raised in a village in the mountains 50 miles to the north. They took piano lessons from the French nuns, and they learned old songs from them. And family singing sessions around the living room piano were a regular occurrence. Their father, Frank, was of Irish-Canadian descent and was steeped in Stephen Foster songs and turn-of-the-century parlor songs. Then from their mother, Gabi, who was French-Canadian, they learned old songs in French. And Kate McGarrigle said in an interview in 1997, quote, "Music was always there at home. At parties, someone would get up and sing, and my father would accompany them and sing the harmony. There were lots of friends and uncles, and each would get up and give their big song, unquote. Really, folks, can we not recover at least a bit of that? Peel your kids off their electronic devices and sing with them regularly, not just at Christmas. And by the way, as I've mentioned earlier in this program, it's not smart to give your children electronic devices until they're out of their body-mind's formative years, that is, out of elementary school. A lot of research studies support this, and that's the way many of the big shots in Silicon Valley, it's come out, are raising their own kids. No computers or electronic games in the house till they're in middle school. Okay, this song we're about to hear was written by Kate McGarrigill, and since she sings the main part, we'll play it in her memory. It's about a dancer who makes grand leaps and is always caught by her partner until one day she's not. In the wake of that traumatic event, she has to become an artist of a different kind, a weaver, but a weaver of wall hangings into which she inserts an image of a dancer with bruised knees on each one. Like a lot of her songs, this seems to be a metaphoric reference to the time when Kate herself was dropped by her performing artist husband, who was a singer, that is, dropped, shockingly, to her for another woman. So Kate McGarrigill then sadly packed up her belongings in a U-Haul trailer and, along with her two babies, who were and are Rufus Wainwright and Martha Wainwright, made that long drive from New York State back home to Montreal, where her sister was, and where they then went on to make several more really fine albums of their own music over the years. So what to say, but that love has ups and downs, but art lives on. Kate McGarrigill surely created a lot of great songs from that painful grist for her creative mill. So here is Dancer with Bruised Knees by Kate and Anna McGarrigill. Dancer with Bruised Knees, sung by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when my guest will be Marianne Williamson. Till next time, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Thank you.